Support for the Commodity Week podcast comes from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign with crop insurance, grain marketing, and commodity brokerage services. Learn more at sfarmmarketing.com. And by ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
They'll look back at 2010 today on Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Welcome to Commodity Week. I'm Todd Gleason. Later in this half hour, we'll talk with Roy Huckabee of the Lynn Group. Our panelists in studio today include Matt Bennett of Total Grain Marketing from Windsor, Illinois, Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois, and Jackie Vakes of Stewart Peterson. She's in Champaign, Illinois.
Support for Commodity Week comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333. And by ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Let's open today's discussion with this question. Paul Cooley, why were the markets so bearish last spring?
Well, we went through a horrible problem, and it was called the housing bubble and the financial crisis on Wall Street. And we do know after the fact that the Fed dumped billions, or trillions of dollars in stabilizing those big money center banks. It brought the economic system that we all love down to its knees. We do know this, that the housing industry is still in pretty rough shape. We do know that we have worked ourselves through some major problems, but it's been the agricultural area that's basically has changed so much in the last year and a half.
Jackie, why so bearish last spring?
Well, I think some of it was related to, in corn especially, to the number of acres that everybody anticipated that we were going to plant. You know, and also knowing that we had had such a poor crop, and a difficult crop that you needed to have something good to be able to blend, and if you didn't, you were going to pay the price for it.
And Matt Bennett,
an extension of that, I think, you know, a lot of people felt like we'd have huge acreage, and a lot of people felt like after having such a poor, frustrating year, we would have a very good year. We didn't think that we would have two back-to-back years, and it looked like our carryout was going to be, you know, at times we were talking 2 billion plus this year, and we also talked under a billion all in the same year, actually in a couple 3-month time period. So there was a variety of reasons to be bearish. Both of these guys had good points. I think one of the biggest things, though, is, you know, a lot of people think that we've got hybrids, and we do have hybrids that are capable of doing things they've never been able to do before. And most people thought this year was going to be the year.
Matt, maybe we should step back a little further than spring and actually go back to the fall of 2009, a harvest that took all the way into, well, the winter of 2010. When you take that crop into account, it was harvested wet, it was harvested in poor condition. What impact did that have on the marketplace as we made our way into early spring and into the summer months?
I think it had a huge impact. I mean, obviously quality was a major concern. As Jackie said, people had to have corn to blend this with. I think it had a large impact in various ways. For instance, agronomically, people fought the damage that they did in 2009 throughout 2010. You know, 2010, people that were able to do tillage, they corrected problems from 2009, 12 months later, and they're still going to be fighting them next spring. I mean, there are large implications from 2009, and how much different of a harvest could we possibly have from the harvest of 2009 and 2010. 2010 was such a great harvest compared to 2009.
Well, and I think his point there being that the harvest was so hard the following, you know, last year, the previous year rather, and it created such a compaction problem, and the fertilizer wasn't applied exactly right. And as a result of it, one of the reasons we had such a yield variability in corn was the compaction problem and, of course, the major heat.
There was a time, Paul, in the spring, which we discussed up front, the markets were at their bottom for the year, but the marketplace was extraordinarily bearish at that time. And then it seemed just confused for about a month and a half to 2 months. 1 week, the analysts that we'd have on Commodity Week would be very bearish. The next week, something would change, and they'd be very bullish. And then they'd be friendly, and then they'd be bearish. Why was the market so confused during that time period?
I think, looking back at it, I think it was a combination that they were trying to trade the corn and soybean market with outside markets. And the other factor is that they absolutely saw no hope and the prices were cheap. And, of course, we're all been told about these new hybrids that are drought resistant. And, those were the kind of things. But I think the other thing is that, there were a lot of people that were confused and too much so.
And I would, looking back, I think one thing that really jumps out at me is we were all so concerned about the way that we left fields in 2009. Compaction, as Paul said, was an issue. But, you know, we had this little window open up at the start of April, and everybody was so thrilled at being able to get into the field that early. All of us would have agreed last spring, we need a really good growing season weather-wise, and it sure looked like we were going to start out the year just like that. And then it turned off cool towards the end of April, and we did get a lot of rain. There was a fair amount of replanting done again. I think weather had a fair amount to do as well with the bullishness and bearishness.
Well, I think when you look at it's pretty typical of a range-bound market. And if you looked at those first 4 months of the year, we were very range-bound, especially in corn. And so, you know, it's difficult to perhaps take a strong stance one way or the other when you have a market that's just basically moving back and forth in a specific range. I think when you take a step back to 2009, we also have to add in a lot of us questioned the numbers that the USDA came up with in January on last year's crop, primarily because we were aware of the fact that we had light test weight. And I think there was an awful lot of overestimating that went on. You know, bins that normally held 50,000 bushels didn't hold 50,000 bushels in 2009 crop. And so when we started to see some of the numbers change on the USDA reports, we started to wonder, boy, are we making adjustments? Because we're actually adjusting the 2009 crop.
So let's talk about the June report since you brought those up. tell me about them. Which ones do you want to start right out with, the acreage report, or you want to start with the Q2 stocks report?
We just got double whammied, more or less. You know, the June report started everything. The acreage report was a shock. The market said, holy cow, what's happening here? Where's this coming from? And then you start to look at the quarterly grain stocks report, the adjustments that were made on the USDA report and on the feed side of things. And I think suddenly the market woke up and said, holy cow, what's happening? And so, then we added the weather from Russia into the picture, and wheat took off.
And that was later in August, of course, so we're still back in June. We have those USDA reports. Feed and residual number says, hey, we're feeding a whole lot of corn really fast.
Yeah, and going back there, one advantage of having a couple of private weather people a phone call away did tell us ahead of time that the Russian problem was there and it was a big, big situation. And the few of us that remember the 1970s, we remember that once those high-pressure blocking patterns get established, they just don't go away very easily. And, of course, I remember that too well. But getting back to the other part of the question, we did have a lot of heat during the summertime. And that was the catalyst. And, of course, the wheat market took off, and then it was an easy deal. But the problem was the farmer had sold way too much in the corn crop.
All right. So everybody wants to jump ahead to August, so let's do that first. As a farmer, talk to me about the heat, because it wasn't heat daytime heat. It was nighttime temperatures, right?
Yeah, and the tough thing about growing corn is whenever you can't give that corn plant a little bit of a chance to take a breather on overnight whenever it's 80 degrees out, we knew darn good and well that we were restricting our production. We knew that the girth of the air probably was going to be not so good at all. And so, you know, going into August, I think many of us, whenever we did our walkthrough in our fields in July, we saw high plant populations. We saw the potential for a pretty decent crop, but the problem was is that the weather wasn't cooperating with us. And so, you know, I guess whenever August, whenever we came out and we said, you know what, the crop isn't going to be quite as good as what we thought, many of us knew it was actually going to be much worse than what the USDA said.
Let's also go back. After the corn crop was planted early, we had a very wet early May there,
right.
And it was major flooding, and it was pretty darn wet, and that meant a delayed plant, and particularly soybeans.
Well, and not only delayed plant, but any time you have an excessive amount of rain right after you've planted and pollinated, you have a lazy root system, and that was probably one of the biggest problems we had, along with heavy population. When you don't get cool nights and you have extremely heavy population, and the fields that's next to our house, the outside rows all had two cobs on them. You went into the inside rows later on, and they had aborted one cob because it just never got cool enough. There just wasn't air movement.
Well, how's come everybody rather believed USDA's August 1 report at where were they? 165? 165.3? I don't remember what that number was, but it was big.
I think that based upon what everyone's expectations were coming into the year, it wasn't as big as what it could have been. I was skeptical as could possibly be with the August report based upon what I was seeing in my own fields. I can tell you that.
Well, right, and I think that the big question on that August 1 report was that we didn't have Iowa as far ahead as what we were. And, you know, the potential out in Iowa was still very strong and in some of those other states. So I think that people didn't necessarily believe it, but didn't have enough information to really doubt it.
That's still in August. Let's get to the other big thing in August. You've mentioned it a couple of times. That was the Black Sea wheat or Russian wheat. We knew, I suppose, that they were having a rough weather situation, but it seemed to just jump upon us suddenly when an Australian firm said, hey, can you shut off the export market in Russia to their administration? And they said, yeah, maybe we should. And that surprised the market, too. What did it do?
Well, I think the world was leaning the wrong direction in Russia, and for the simple reason that we know that from the communist era that they did have some really upside-down production years. And we also thought that this new capitalist planting progress and new farmer in Ukraine and Russia was a better farmer, and this just didn't happen. But the heat was tremendous, and it stayed with them for a long time. And it not only affected their wheat, but their oilseed crops and probably their livestock production. So this was a real multiplier effect. And the thing that we really thought would happen is that the Russians would come into the grain market in the world like they did in the communist era and come in and buy things with both feet. They're coming in gradually off the cuff and doing some covering now. But we really thought that you know, the shoe would drop again.
Well, and I think one of the things that I know I was guilty of is just not paying enough attention to wheat. When you look at wheat from June until that August report, we'd already gained $1.60 on the wheat market. You know, none of us were focused on it. Everybody was looking at corn and beans. And then suddenly this big thing comes out and bang, it just took off from there.
And that kick-started the market for corn, and then we'll stay in August. USDA has to take a look and has a stocks report that comes out in September and says, well, there's an all. It says what? I'll let you.
Well, you come up with 300 million more bushels of stocks than what everyone thought, basically. And most of us said, you know what, there was a ton of harvesting done in August. I mean, a lot of guys started harvesting 2 weeks before their earliest record date was before. Many elevators had a lot of grain on hand as of September 1st. So it was a very head-scratching number, if you will. Most people were looking for some sort of language to come out that, hey, you know what, we had to include some, but that's not what we were told. And so it was a very interesting report.
Yeah, but, you know, you're a good guy, but the thing they left out of the picture is that the inventory and carryover they had was so much junk, they couldn't do anything but ship the new crop out instead of the old crop. And there was such a tremendous inventory balance.
Well, we talked
that
about
that That was the problem.
Damaged corn. You guys said it before we started the show. Damaged corn made the difference.
Right, and I'll totally agree with you, Paul. That the failure is that when the report is, when the information for the report is actually accumulated, the only question that is asked is, how much old crop corn do you still have? They don't ask, did you substitute any new crop corn with the old crop corn? Because that's not what the grain stocks report is all about. And so in a year like this, it makes for a really difficult situation. There are estimates out there that we had actually harvested about over 300 million more bushels of corn by September 1st than what we had the year before. But there was no way of really accounting for where that corn went to.
Well, we've made it to the end of the beginning of the show, and we've only gotten to September, and not even all the way through that. We have another USDA report that changed things 10 days later. We'll talk about that in just a couple of minutes when we turn here on Commodity Week. Our panelists in studio are Matt Bennett of Total Grain Marketing, Jackie Vakes of Stewart Peterson, and Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services. Roy Huckabee of the Lynn Group will join us in the second half, too. Commodity Week, of course, is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Support for Commodity Week comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333. And by ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
This is our special look back edition of Commodity Week for 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. Our panelists in studio include Jackie Vakes of Stewart Peterson, Matt Bennett of Total Grain Marketing, and Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services. Roy Huckabee of the Lynn Group is with us as our guest today. He has 30 years of experience, of course. Roy's a principal of the firm and part of the management team. Roy, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Todd.
Now, as we finished up the beginning part of our program, we had made it through a portion of the year, all the way to mid-September. There was a 10-day period there where the markets decided to go sharply lower, that after the quarterly grain stocks report was released for Q2. And then USDA dropped another bombshell of a report on us with the crop production and WASDE numbers. Tell me what happened at that point.
Well, the markets had an issue with the production numbers. So we were also having problems in the FSU where we lost our cheap seller of feed wheat and barley around the world. So the markets immediately started to react to that, and the flat price went searching for some sort of rationing mechanism.
And did it find it very quickly?
No. No, we rallied the markets pretty hard.
That despite the fact that we were in the midst of an early harvest?
The harvest came very rapidly, I agree. The activity was the lowest moisture that we'd ever taken out during harvest time, and yields just kept getting worse and worse and worse. The yields across the eastern belt were the first ones to come in. The western belt was assumed to be better. But as we know, as we got into the crop, all of the yields started to suffer, and even the good crops in Minnesota and Iowa and Nebraska ended up at lower yields.
Roy, we're talking about the October report, and I guess just in retrospect, how surprised were you at how drastic the yield cut was for October?
Well, I have to tell you that I drove across central Illinois during that late August, early September time frame, and I was in the middle of fields that were turning white and well before being mature, and I was concerned about what the yields were doing, and I had to go home and pull up weather maps and go back and depict the moisture and the rain we had for the last 45 days just to figure out how big the area was. And what we found was that area just kept growing. It was the area that I was in was west central Illinois, but it affected a lot of the corn crop in the eastern belt.
You know, Roy, one of the things that the November report brought about was some changes in the beans. Were you surprised by that, by the yield change?
I was. I felt like the bean yields would do better, and I was surprised at that. I'm still not sure that the USDA has been quite right, and I think that in the January report we may find that there's some adjustments with beans going up and corn coming down, in my mind.
Roy, would you have around a lot of farmers and farmer meetings. Do you have a feeling and do you have a strong feeling about the final production on corn and soybeans in the January report? And then also, what kind of a planting mix are the farmers telling you out here in the Midwest?
Well, I'm in Champaign-Urbana today, and I just met with 120 farmers in the Holiday Inn. And the guys here don't see much change in their mix. I think that the areas where you could see a change is in spring wheat areas. The areas in western Kansas, basically we've seen a 2.5 million or 3 million acre increase in winter wheat plantings. And if you looked at the farmer that planted winter wheat back 3 weeks ago, he was feeling pretty bad about not only what his stands look like, but what the market was giving him for returns on wheat. And there was this huge conversation about destroying wheat in springtime to make room for additional corn and bean acres. We feel like we need another 5 million acres of corn in the springtime, and at this point, I don't think that's that easy to get. So something's got to buy acres away from something else. You've got cotton prices trying to buy acres, and you've got bean prices trying to keep their acres together, and corn prices, of course, searching for more.
Yeah, talk to me about those cotton prices and whether they're really trying to buy acres. I have not looked at next year's crop, but wasn't it this year's crop, the one that was just harvested in the last month or so, that was really pushed and not the 2011 crop?
Absolutely, but when you look at the inverses that developed, it pulled the new crop cotton up to $10 and I think, and higher. I don't have charts in front of me in cotton, but I think that it certainly created an environment where all around the world we were looking at increased cotton acres, that we took cotton away from beans in South America, and we're doing it here in the U.S. in the springtime, if these prices hold together.
Roy, I know several farmers in our area who applied fertilizer. As far as dry fertilizer, they weren't able to get their anhydrous on because the ground was too dry. I'm talking on chiseled corn stalks. If
right.
You're a farmer in a productive area and you've got the flexibility, you know, the fertilizer's not going anywhere. You can plant beans if you want. But I'd like to know whether you would, at this juncture, if you'd be able to make a distinction on what you would do, whether it was planting corn or beans, and what would you do marketing-wise to go along with that?
Well, if the group that I talked to today, I told them that I wouldn't be in any big hurry to market anything in the new crop. I felt like if you were able to book insurance, I would certainly be booking as much insurance as I could. That gives you a downside put on prices. And then you wait for the markets to do the rationing that I think needs to be done before the summer's out. I'm still very bullish, and I think that the market has to go fight for acres. And I think that the revenue stream at today's prices on new crop corn and beans is in the neighborhood of $475 an acre in net revenue or net to rent, whatever, however you want to look at your total cost, but all the variable costs besides land cost, paying it gives you about a $470 to $480 return. In wheat, 2 weeks ago, that number was down to less than $100 an acre in revenue, and today, if you can do beans behind wheat, if you're south of I-70, for instance, in Illinois and Missouri and Indiana, you can look at $470, $480 returns on putting beans in behind winter wheat. The exact numbers that I had on yesterday's closes was $471 an acre on soft wheat with beans behind it, and the 200 bushel corn gave me $428, and 60 bushel beans gave me $460.
Right. You know, you've talked a number of times about price rationing. What do you see as the prices that would ration the market?
Well, I would have thought that $6 corn would have hurt our ethanol consumption 4 months ago. And it's been amazing to me that the ethanol industry has been able to weather that, and the industry that's gotten hurt has been cattle and hogs and dairy. And I know that the dairy is really suffering now with a $15 cost in milk and a $12.50 milk check. And I think that the people that were marketing cattle at 104 2 weeks ago that hadn't hedged anything were putting $250 a head in the bank. But I think that there's no way that you can do that in today's environment. When wheat, when corn broke 90 cents last month, I think the best we could have done was lock in about a $30 a head loss on cattle. I think hogs at one point got up to where they were break even, maybe a $7 profit for the good guys. But I think today corn's running away from the livestock prices again.
What's the next move in the market, and where is it going to come from?
I think that to address Australia, the initial thought in corn this week was that Australia was making feed wheat. And with 5 million tons of feed wheat now announced by the ABARE and 5 million tons out of Stats Can, we got 10 million tons of feed wheat for the world to use, and that replaced all of the feed wheat we lost out of Russia, and that's bearish corn. But I think that my contacts in Australia are scared to death of a 3 or 4 million ton abandonment in wheat, and that means that it just goes away. When you look at the world feed grain situation, I think it's just extremely tight, and I'm having a hard time getting enough acres around the world to make that tightness go away. So the USDA's got to address the situation in China. China has told the world that they think the reason their corn prices are so high domestically is because of the speculator, and of course they've gone to work to control that. They've raised their margins on the futures positions. They've limited the amount of corn that anybody can buy from the government reserves. And I think that they've been able to talk the price of corn down for about the last 3 weeks. But if you are in China and you're looking around and you're wondering what you do for corn in April, May, June, you're very concerned. And I think all of these actions, the Chinese government can be successful for 30 days or 60 days, but what they've done is actually tighten the supply in their domestic markets down the road. In 1996, the last time China bought large quantities of imported wheat and corn, they did it in the second week of December. Now, I don't know if that timing is important or not, but I think that there is an issue here that this is about the time they get a better handle on what their crops are. And believe me, they're not trying to find out. The control of the speculator is one thing. I know the government keeps talking about how much better the crops are, but I believe that's rhetoric only, and that at some point they have to start importing corn. The corn they bought last summer was bought when U.S. worked into their southern ports duty paid 50 cents below what their domestic market was trading. Today, that we can't do that. The corn price has rallied too much in the U.S. But to replace government reserves, they don't have to pay that import duty, and corn would certainly work in cheap enough to do that.
Roy Huckabee is with the Lynn Group. He joined us here on our look back at 2010, a special edition of Commodity Week. Our panelists in studio today included Matt Bennett of Total Grain Marketing, Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services, and Jackie Vanks of Stuart Peterson. You have a good holiday season. I'm Todd Gleason. Okay, Roy, thank you.
I have to ask, is that different from what you guys talked about before I got on?
Yes. Altogether different.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
No, I have to admit, I'm ravingly bullish.
Hey, he's pulling your leg. we're just talking about the previous year and the growing season. You did a beautiful job, and thanks for taking the time to share it with us on a Thursday afternoon.
Oh, I thought, I'm sorry. different in terms of direction or different in terms of direction of the commodity prices? The answer is no. No, not different there, but different in terms of content, yes, and the kinds of things you discussed is what I meant.
It just followed.
We hadn't taken much up about the Chinese and how they work internally. So,
yeah. We had a Christmas party in the office next to us at the Board of Trade today. And I went over at about 11:30 before I drove down to Champaign. And the you get to rub elbows with a lot of your old friends off the floor that you haven't seen in a long time. I haven't been on the floor for about 8 years now. And I have to tell you, everybody was ravingly bullish. Very hard to take this market up the way I think it should when everybody's bullish.
Yeah.
What happens is that you get a lot of fits and starts. Market tries to rally, dies.
Yep.
Tries to break, consumers step in. Fits and starts is the way I would describe it.
Yeah, it's another one of those lost periods.
Oh, I think it's not a lost period. I think it's a period when we grow. I think that it's good for me because you can buy and sell. You can build a long position and trade around it, and that's good for commissions. Got to put shoes on the babies.
Hey, yeah. I got a question for all of you, and I didn't ask this, but the recorder's still on, so I might use it later, so be careful with your answers. So we have doubled the price of grains and oil seeds, roughly speaking. We have doubled the price of crude oil. In the 70s, we went from $1.20 corn to $2.40 corn as a midpoint. Are we at $4.80, $4.50 as a midpoint? What's the trading range, or is it higher than that this time around? And is this a true plateau? Roy, we'll start with you since they want to.
Well, I think that if you would have asked me this question 6 months ago or 12 months ago, I would have told you that our new plateau was $3.50, that the $3.50 had value, and that the corn market would trade higher through the year. I didn't see it as high as it is today. I have to admit that at 420, 415, we were actively pricing new crop corn back in February and March, earlier in the year. But I think that we are moving to a new plateau, and I think that the ability of the world to feed itself has, again, been put to question, and we hope that the corn yields continue to go up so that question gets answered in a positive manner. But I think you've got a new gorilla in the marketplace, and when China decides to buy something, price is no object.
I agree very much with what you said, Roy, and I guess, like I said earlier, if you'd asked me in June if we're going to have a $2 rally in the corn market, I would have said no way. I didn't, I wouldn't have seen that. And I didn't see that, obviously, or I'd have been long a couple million bushels of corn. I wouldn't be sitting here right now. But I think as far as the plateau goes, I agree a lot with what he said. And here's one thing. The corn that we sold at 350, 360, 370 this past year, the farmer sold it too early, but he made money on it with his production costs last year. Okay, and so if I'm looking for a value level or a plateau level, I don't think that we're clear up to 480 yet, based upon where we sit right here today. I think there's too many unknowns, too many variables. We don't know what crude oil is going to do. We don't know what the dollar is going to do. So I would probably ratchet it back from the 480, but I don't think I would go back to the 350 either. I might settle in closer to the $4 range.
That was my number last year, right?
Right. And, when I think there's a couple of things that the dynamic has changed in the market, and one is primarily because of the recession itself. We saw the marketplace going hand to mouth for inventories, and suddenly we saw a recession. We saw some shortages, and I think that you've seen a change in the end user attitude in some cases where they've actually wanted to come out here. And when I say end user, I'm talking about countries like China, India, places like that, where they're saying, we need to have more stocks on hand. And I think with the increases that we've seen in the values on commodities, we've also seen the same increases come in the cost of inputs. It's very, that raises your plateau as far as I'm concerned, because it makes it more difficult for anybody to entice someone to plant a crop if they have to pay a lot for input. So I'm looking at a plateau. If I have to choose one, I'm probably going to say the 450 level with a range that could be 350 to 550, you know.
Roy, at the Christmas party there on the that you went to, my bet is, and I'd bet a dollar bill, is that the cowboys that are so bullish, I don't believe their book is actually as large as it their hopes are that we'll see a big rally this coming year. In other words, their positions are pretty small with the increased volatility and the increased margin requirements. Is that true?
Well, I think absolutely. If you were as bullish corn and wheat as I was last month, you had to sit through a 97-cent break in corn. You had to sit through a $1.40 break in wheat. You get killed. So people have found ways to trade around it. They're doing options. They do vertical call spreads. They trade in and out of positions. But you're very defensive, very defensive. But I think that in this meeting that we just did this afternoon, I talked about the revenues per acre. If I'm guaranteeing myself $500 an acre on the ground that I've got to pay $500 to rent, I really don't have much income. So I think that the dynamics of the ag sector are changing, and I think that it doesn't cost that much more to make fertilizer today, but the fertilizer industry wants a share of this farmer's revenue. The seed company wants a share of this farmer's revenue. Everybody's got their hand in the farmer's pocket looking for a little more return.
Well, I have a question about that. So because the farmer, most people say, well, the fertilizer company wants a share of that. But isn't it simply a function of the price of energy? I mean, truly a function of the price of energy. And while you might say they're taking advantage of current situation, when we jumped energy prices in 07, 08, and suddenly we had $1,000 anhydrous, right, or $900 anhydrous, it dropped back.
You're 750 to 800 today.
Right.
Whereas we were 500.
Of course, we were trading 125, 140 for crude at that time, too.
We were 500 at the end of the summer this year.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a 50% increase, and I don't think it's all energy by any means. I think it's got a heck of a lot to do with the rally in the corn market, like Roy said.
Well, and I would agree with that to a point, but I also think it has to do with Roy said 5 million more acres of corn. Okay, along with that, always comes the expectation. You know, we're just not overflowing in fertilizer. We get 50% of our fertilizer from outside the United States. And so
expected
we don't have total,
demand.
You know, we don't have total control of that.
Roy, when you're out here on the deal, would you agree with us that 80% of the corn crop, I mean, the beans and corn have been sold already out in the country or more?
I think that the farmer sold more beans than he did corn. I think that he sold his beans right off the combine. It was a lot of money, and it was something that he could take to the bank right away. I think that he sold 40-45% of his corn before he actually got into the combine. And because he sold a lot of it cheaper than the prices were at the fall, and his yield tended to go down, I think he tended to hold corn. And the corn was so dry, it went into farm storage, really. He's got corn.
Are you walking because we're losing you?
Oh, I'm sorry. Is this
you're back,
better?
You're back now, yeah.
I guess I'll repeat. I think that the farmer sold 40% of his corn before he ever got in the combine. I think he sold a lot of his beans off the combine. And the corn was stored very easily this fall. It came out very dry. A lot of corn was harvested at 13 to 14% moisture. And I think it went into farm bins. I think he's got a lot of corn on farm.
I can't speak for every area, but I know in my particular area that 40% or 50% that he sold turned out to be a much higher percentage. And maybe in some areas the final percentage was 40%. But I know a lot of guys in my neighborhood that sold pretty close to what they raised, and they thought they were selling 60 to 70%. A lot of the corn yields in our area were very disappointing, as much so as the bean yields were very, very excellent. So it was basically a kind of a two different worlds there.
Your hunch on China, how much are they going to buy on both corn and beans here in the next 30 to 45 days, you think?
Well, they've bought U.S. beans all the way out through April and May, and I think that the pace on beans will slow down a little bit as the Brazilian beans become available. I just don't know what they've done in corn. I can't get my arms around it. I think that my early estimates were that they would buy 5 million tons of corn this year. They bought 1.5 million last year. But I think that they need to replenish their reserves. They need to get the government reserves back up to 25 million, and I think that might take 15 million tons of corn.
Jeez.
So I don't know anything. I know that the people in China that I talk to are very bullish corn, and they're just waiting on the government to make a decision.
On the other side of the corn picture, what do you anticipate as far as DDG usage and demand from China? I mean, that's another way of taking corn from us.
Well, actually, it's interesting you say that because when I first saw, they bought about 8 cargoes of DDGs in late July, early August. And for them to take vessel quantities, I was quite impressed with it. But when I start looking at what they were doing, I think they were replacing meal, not corn.
Right. They're replacing meal in their hog rations.
Right. The DDGs that they brought in was the cheapest source of protein that they had at the time.
And they didn't have to pay freight on it going back.
Mm-hmm.
It was freight from Illinois to Pacific Coast and then free on board the rest of the way.
Roy, when you talked about trading the market, you know, with the dips and whatnot, how scared would you be to sell, you know, say a Dece 11 corn, a $10 option at 13 cents?
Yeah, well, you know, let's be realistic. 750s are trading at 50 cents, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that I don't mind selling that, but it's not going to go down.
Yes.
I mean, you got the whole summer to go through.
Right.
And it's about 43 or 44% volatility. I think before we're done in the summer, the volatility will get to 50%. Mm-hmm. So you'll have a better chance.
So just wait.
I think your marketing decisions will be made in March, April, May this year.
Thanks for taking your time to be with us, Roy.
Yep, we appreciate it, Roy. Thank you.
Well, yeah. Everybody's got horns now. You can't get out the door, right?
They had horns.
Not all at once.
Not all at the same time. Somebody will get trampled on the way out. That's always the case.
Well, I'm lucky. My coat's still hanging on the coat rack.
There you go. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Roy.
Safe drive back to Chicago. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.